Thanks for being here this evening. My name is Kevin Conover, and we're broadcasting down here in Southern California. We're on KPRZ 1210 AM, as well as FM 106.1 in North County. And then, of course, we're all over the web and the internet. And you can check us out on, if you like to see video, you can see us on YouTube. Or you can just listen on podcast. Either way is great. And we've got a great show lined up here this evening. My guest is Dr. Tim Clary. He's received a Master of Science in Geology in 1984 from the University of Wyoming and a Master of Science in Hydrogeology in 1993 from Western Michigan University. He received his PhD in Geology in 1996 from Western Michigan University. And he actually worked for Chevron from 1984 to 1992, where he was an exploration geologist. So he has hands-on experience here in geology, developing oil drilling prospects and analyzing assets and lease purchases. He was full professor and geosciences chair at Delta College in Michigan for 17 years before leaving in 2013 to join the science staff at the Institute for Creation Research, which is based in Texas, if you don't know about them. And he's published many papers and authored many books. And one of his most recent books is called Carbon Stone. And that book specifically deals with the progression of the global flood, of Noah's flood. So how did that all take place? And this is kind of, in a sense, cutting edge geology, the study of the progression of the flood, because it is, okay, what initiated things, and then how did things develop? And so Dr. Clary, thanks so much for being on the program today.
Oh, it's a pleasure being here. It really is.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited to hear what you have to say. Is that true, what I'm saying, that this is kind of a cutting edge research as far as, you know, where we're heading in creation science?
Well, it really is. I mean, until I began this program about 10 years ago, joining ICR, there's really no one has done anything like this. Henry Morris kind of changed the world with his book he and John Whitcomb put in 1961 out there, and kind of gave people an alternative to, you know, the uniformitarianism or the evolutionary story of geology. But he didn't really have the data. I mean, he looked at all the papers that were published, but this is brand new data that no one has done anything like this. There's nobody, even to my knowledge, even in the evolutionary world, that's going continent by continent, plotting up the oil well data, which, again, I see God's hand in my history that I was able to do that for a while with Chevron to learn how to use these oil wells better than maybe most people maybe not as familiar with it. And so it's really been a blessing to go around and plot up, you know, one continent and then the next continent and the next continent. And when I was with oil and gas company, we couldn't, you know, they look at little tiny areas. You couldn't look at the whole continental scale. So even the oil and gas geologists, when I go to conferences and present some of this, I have to be careful on my wording. I can't mention the flood, but I can talk about flooding events. And we see multiple flooding events that ultimately, you know, that kind of progressed along until, well, eventually, I believe the data even shows, the evidence is strong to show there was one point in history when everything flooded. And we'll get a chance to look at a few of the maps that I've compiled. I left all my maps in today's sort of configuration for the continents, even though we do believe there was a Pangaea type, maybe a little bit different than a little modified. But basically, there was a Pangaea that moved apart very quickly during the flood year. And then that really was the mechanism, I believe, for the flood, was the creation of a whole new seafloor very quickly. And that kind of goes back to John Baumgartner's work.
Yes, John Baumgartner. Yeah, he's fantastic. And geophysicist, and he's done all kinds of work as well. And so that's what, you know, I'm really interested in, and I'm sure our guests are interested in, is what is this evidence, and why did you decide to focus on this particular area of the flood? What caused you to decide, hey, this is where I'm gonna focus my research? Because like you said, there is no other book. Carbon Stone is really the only book that addresses this really in existence. That book came out in 2020. If you're listening and you're interested, you can get this on ICR's website, icr.org. Tell us a little bit about that. What caused you to decide this is where I want to focus?
Well, really, it was John Morris was instrumental in bringing me to ICR. And so he just passed away a year or two ago. He was also my mentor for a while, the first few years I was at ICR. But it was really his idea and his brother, Henry Morris III, that really said, maybe you should start working on this column project. And it was something I wanted to do for several years, but I just never had the time to do it. And I tried to get other geologists in the creation community to work on this as well, but nobody ever seemed to have the time. So ICR allowed me the time by the donors that give to ICR to pay my salary for me to do this. And so I spent a lot of my time in the office compiling data, looking for data, finding data. You know, I don't get to go to these places, but I can find all the data online if you do enough data mining. And, but it's very tedious. But
eventually, it's a lot of work.
You can get the data. And what we do is we have all these columns over, I think, around 3,000 columns now globally. But it really started out with just looking at North America and kind of building out and seeing what we had. And then we went to Africa. Then we went to South America, all those pieces that kind of close the Atlantic back up. So we tried to do the pieces back and forth, Europe, those four major continents first. And then we started really seeing the pattern. And that's when I wrote the Carbon and Stone book. Henry Morris III says, we got to get a book out there showing what you're finding. We can't wait till you get done. So, but it does show the same pattern that I'm seeing on all the other continents since I finished. So we've got five continents done now, almost have six continents, which is Australia, done. And they're all showing the same pattern. I'll show a few slides here in a minute to kind of show you what I mean.
So break it down for us in kind of layman's terms. What exactly is it that you're looking at? What patterns are you finding that are pointing to a worldwide flood? What is it exactly that you're looking at?
Okay, I'm plotting up all the rock data, all the sedimentary rocks, and even some of the volcanic rocks in the world. And I'm doing it by plotting up every major basin, every major uplift. There's a geologic column, it's called, or a stratigraphic column. So if you drilled a well right where you're sitting, right all the way down to the crust, all those thousands of feet or hundreds of feet or wherever you live, sometimes no feet, you're right at the crust, right down to the basement, you know, which is granite or metamorphic rocks. We compile by latitude and longitude, that point is, you know, just like you drilled a well all the way down. So you have so many thousands of, we use meters, meters of sandstone, limestone, whatever it is, all the way down. We also pick what's called mega sequence boundaries, which are these sequence boundaries where even the evolutionists believe there were floods that came in and backed off and came in and backed off. They just believe it took place over millions of years. We see that it's all one continuous year-long flood, like the Bible describes. There's no evidence of time in between the layers. You just see stacked layers, just like you see in Grand Canyon. But really,
just to make sure that I understand what you're saying, what you're doing is, and I'm sure everybody that's listening is familiar with the Grand Canyon, and you see the layers going down the Grand Canyon. So what you're essentially doing is looking at oil, where they've dug for oil, and you can actually see that same strata, but in different places all over the continent and all over the world.
Exactly. That's a very good way to look at it. You kind of see Grand Canyon and you can see the layers. I think God almost purposely carved that out during the receding phase of the flood so we could see what was down below.
Yeah.
And in the last century, of course, we've been drilling wells. And so we're able to extend that same rocks in Grand Canyon all the way across North America. And we're seeing some of those same rocks exist on almost all the continents of the world in the same order, the same pattern. Even the fossils are the same order. And you'll see the extent sets up minimal flooding, which we never knew this before. We never knew how the flood really, it was a progressive flood. Even though you read Genesis 7, it's hard to miss that it was a progressive flood. It kept getting higher, exceedingly higher, exceedingly higher. So I encourage the listeners to read Genesis 7 and then think about what I'm seeing in the rocks. The rocks really do show that there is a pattern to the flood, that every continent does almost the same thing at the same time. But it wasn't until we put all this data into the, you know, each continent by continent by continent, we started seeing those patterns. And so nobody really knew this. And so to my knowledge, nobody is doing anything like this except, the research that I get to do at ICR. And I feel it's a real blessing. I mean, to me, as a geologist, it excites me because this is like every continent is like open up a new Christmas present. You kind of see how it ties into the next one and the next one. But they all show a very similar pattern, as we'll see here in just a moment.
That is so amazing. Now, a couple questions here, again, just to break it down into layman's terms. So when you say it's a progressive flood, the alternative would be, what is the alternative? A non-progressive flood? What is the difference between a progressive flood and a,
Some people say it flooded everything right away. And that's pretty
meaning
common.
That all the water was there
all
at
the water
once,
went up right away and flooded everything right away, or maybe the first 40 days.
Yeah.
I don't see that. I think that with the work of John Baumgartner and his geophysics showing it was what he believes, and I think is the case, of runaway subduction. The evidence backs that there's really strong evidence because you have really cold slabs of lithosphere or crust deep in the earth, all the way down to the mantle. And so those, if they went down really slow, they wouldn't still be cold. And so there is evidence to back up his ideas, and his math has never been shown to be wrong. And so I believe that's the mechanism that God used to bring about the flood. And it took 150 days to reach the maximum according to the biblical text, at least that's the way we see it. It's pretty clear that it wasn't just an immediate flooding, like some people have said. Some creationists have said it floods everything right away. But then you'd have all these, you know, T-Rexes mixed in with trilobites, and you don't see that. You see a very order to the fossils because there's a progressive flood. They went higher and higher, flooding different ecological zones as it went higher and higher. And we've identified about three basic zones of flooding based on what we see of the rocks, how they kind of lay out the lowest areas first and then the next area. And it really makes a lot of sense.
So the water, the Bible says that all the fountains of the deep burst forth on one day. So the waters come out of the crust of the earth and then they begin to spread out across the earth, almost like a pool that's filling up, right?
Very, very violently, you know, these are tsunami waves that were bigger than anything we've witnessed. They might've been, there's some estimates based on some of the sand waves we see, maybe 500 foot high waves. Whereas today a tsunami wave can kill hundreds of thousands of people with a 50 foot wave that covers a big area.
And so the water
burst, right? The fountains burst out, water and lava came out. We can see evidence of that in the rocks still. We can still see the lavas where these cracks opened up on the East Coast, and the West Coast, the United States, and around the world. But how much water came out, you know, it's unclear. But a lot of the water might have been in the pre-flood ocean. So you really just have to push the bottom of the ocean out. And as you made a new seafloor during the splitting of the continents, you push the seafloor up progressively as well. And that progressive rise in seafloor, because of like a hot air balloon, hot new crust pushes things up. And so as that progressed along, it pushed more and more. The waves went higher and higher and higher and higher still. Eventually, they went over the top. And then there's a point where they started to cool, and then they started to sink again. The ocean crust kind of sank and cooled, and then that drew the water back. And so there was a point where God knew what he was doing. He's making up ocean crust. And we do see the whole ocean is new. The whole ocean formed during the flood year. It only goes back to what you call maybe Triassic or whatever those terms are, Jurassic, Jurassic is the oldest ocean crust, which is really midway through the flood. And so it's I do believe that the work of John Baumgartner showing the runaway subduction or catastrophic plate tectonics, the progressive creation of new seafloor at several meters per second, several yards per second, not like today's movements this much per year. During the flood year, until you used up all that cold original crust and it sank into the earth, and then everything was hot and everything kind of stopped, so you kind of ran out of the drive, was that difference in density. A little technical here, but that's basically what happened is the flood used up all the original crust of the earth, and the process pushed the water higher and higher. So the tsunami waves kept going higher and higher and higher on every continent. And that's exactly the pattern we see. God did do a judgment for the wickedness of mankind, but it took about 150 days before all humanity was wiped out. So he could have done it quicker. He could have done it in a day, but the rocks show, and the biblical text describes a 150-day rise in the flood. And that's what the rocks show based on the geophysics and the geology that I'm seeing. There's a perfect match between John Baumgartner's work and my work. And fortunately, I had the chance to talk right after him a couple of times. And I said, well, he's the guy that gave us the mechanism. And here's what the results are. Here's what we see on the continents. And so the continents really do reflect exactly what the biblical text says, which is, Why would we be surprised? I mean, I've got the best job in the world. I get to tell people God's word is true.
Yeah, absolutely.
How do you beat
it? But now you're examining, oil drilling points all over the world. That's what you're examining, right?
Right, and sometimes it's seismic data that goes through. They shoot seismic data that goes through the wells, so you can extend out the information a little bit farther. Mm-hmm. But a lot of it's based on the actual wells. Or measured stratigraphic columns, where people can walk up a mountain and they can measure the rock thicknesses physically.
So here's my question for you then. Mm-hmm. Based on that what you're seeing, and you're concluding that this is a worldwide flood, whereas a secularist would say, no, these are local floods spread out over millions of years. Why is it that your conclusion is matching the data, and what would we see differently if the secularist, the uniformitarian geologists were correct? What would be seen differently?
Well, they wouldn't be able to explain the progressive nature of the flood. They try to say there's a couple different times where, and I'll show you a diagram. They think there was a high sea level flooding early in the history of the earth, and then it backed off and it came back in again. I just see one sort of steady step-by-step increase, and that's what the rocks reflect. So they don't have a model to explain what I'm seeing because it's so new. But they don't really, you know, their argument would be, of course, well, we believe in floods. They believe in, you know, a lot of flooding, but they don't believe it ever flooded everything. And I do have evidence to support that. And secondly, they don't believe in the progression of the flood, where it was, you know, burying the marine rocks first, burying marine critters. That's why you find marine animals only, almost exclusively, in the earliest flood rocks. And then you start to hit the land, and you start to get coal seams and land animals all at once, all over the world. I mean, it's a global thing. I put this out to people. I said, how do you explain this without a global phenomenon? And it's just crickets. I mean, nobody has replied to what the data I'm seeing. I've had evolutionists read through. Here's a shameless plug. I've had evolutionists read my book. I've sent one to a well-known author who writes geology textbook. And he, you know, he didn't want to pay for it. I mailed it to him and said, here. And he read through the whole thing, and he didn't complain about my data at all. He just said, well, I love your data, because the data is the real rocks that are there, that, you know, we're the only ones doing it. He said, we love your data, but we hate your interpretation. You know, he really didn't like that. At the end, I point to Jesus. It's all about salvation through Jesus, that there was a judgment.
You know, yeah.
People that, once that door was shut on the ark, if you weren't at it, your fate was sealed. You're going to be dead within the next 150 days. And
yeah,
the same thing is true in life. You know, we're here on earth. We have to make that decision for Christ. God calls us. We have to accept that calling, to accept, to, you know, what Jesus did, the sacrifice, you know, God himself coming to earth, shedding his blood and offering that salvation free to everybody. And just like people had a chance for salvation during the flood, they could have got on the ark. That door was salvation. Well, Jesus is the door. He's even said that he's the door of salvation today. And so we all have an opportunity to escape judgment, because our sins are forgiven.
Yeah. And it certainly looks like the judgment's not too far away. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, it seems it's definitely closer every day. I mean,
that's right. You can't deny that.
Literally and figuratively.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and Jesus references the flood. He says, "As it was in the day of Noah." So, I mean, it is the evidence that what Jesus says is true, and that judgment is coming. So,
but to me, you know, it's not just, you know, we don't just have to have a blind faith. We've got data, data to back up that there was rapid plate movement. You can see these cold slabs deep in the earth. I don't have a picture of that, but in my book, I show a few of those. That there's cold slabs that go all the way down to the mantle, which the evolutionists can't explain. They just kind of remote on this whole subject. They don't bring it up. And they, you know, they that kind of verifies John Baumgartner was on the right track. And they also see the data that I'm showing of a progressive flood. And, you know, it's, they got to admit that something global was going on. It's just hard not to deny it.
Yeah. Well, this would be great if you could share those slides that you have, just
I'll give it a try here. Let's see what we got. I'll share these, and then I'll go to slideshow. It's going to start right from the start. You're going to see the progression of the flood. So you're going to see these six sequences I'll explain in just the next slide, and I'll show it again at the end. But you're going to see how they pancake on top of each other, just like the Grand Canyon, like you mentioned. You can see it there, but I've extended this across the continent. I've extended this across multiple continents. And we're also going to see the continents in the way they are today. During the flood, they would have started out very close together in the first few sequences, but you're going to still see the idea of the progressive flood, very little flooding early, then more and more, and suddenly a whole lot more, and then you'll see it, the water goes down. So let's run this through and see how this goes.
So I wanted to ask you also, because, you know, somebody who's studying, again, secular geology, and they look at the Grand Canyon, they see the strata, the layers there. What I've heard typically is an evolutionary or a uniformitarian explanation is that over millions of years, you have different layers being created, and that's how they got there, right? That's their claim.
Well, they say that, but all the rocks in the world, they say that. But, you know, the counter argument to that is, how do you have, like, between the Red Wall Limestone, which is a, you know, Mississippi and whatever you want to call it, it's an early flood sediment where it's almost all marine rocks. Well, that same limestone goes all the way across the United States. It's the same limestone that makes caves in Mammoth Cave, that makes caves in the Black Hills. It's the same limestone that covers that whole area. Just like the Tapete sandstone, the bottom of Grand Canyon, it's the same sandstone that goes all the way up to New York and Michigan. It's the same layer, and that's only a couple hundred feet thick. So how do you have these layers of sediment that are just a few hundred feet thick that go all the way across essentially the whole 48 states? And so that's,
and so would they say, they would say, oh, well, there was a flood that covered the entire United States. Is that what their claim would be?
No, they actually wouldn't go that far. They kind of say it progressed along over millions of years. Yeah, like a beach that came in and kept progressing along, getting deeper and deeper and deeper as the water rose and the water went back down, of course, over millions of years. Well, you look at the layers, you look at the red wall, you look at what's below it. You see there's supposed to be 160 million years of time between the red wall and the Muav limestone below it. And everywhere you look in Grand Canyon, just like all the layers, you can do this. You know, other layers are supposed to be a million years, 10 million years here and there. They're perfectly flat. There's no evidence of major erosional events. Grand Canyon itself is supposed to have been formed now, they think, in about 6 million years. Why aren't there, in 160 million years of time, why aren't there some Grand Canyons cutting into this layer? Why is it just perfectly flat limestone on perfectly flat limestone? And you see that again. The Coconino sandstone sitting right on top of this Hermit Shale. It's supposed to be about a million years of time or more there as well. And that's the pattern you see all over the world. Right? You see rock layers on rock layers. There's no evidence of time missing in between.
Yeah, there's no erosion between the layers.
Yeah, very little erosion at all, if anything. It's just, you know, how do they, and you'll see the pancaking in this little first little video clip, you know, just kind of piling on top of each other. Mm-hmm. And to me, there's no time in between, yet evolutionists say there's millions of years between each one of these layers, but the evidence is not there. That's what you see in Grand Canyon. That's what these cores show. That not just there, it extends across the country. So let me run through this, and I'll give you a little bit of a. So watch carefully here. This is the Sauk, the first sequence, and then the next layer on top of that, and the next layer on top of that, and then we start to really expand. And that's where you flood the land, and then you high point of the flood, and then you have the receding phase. And so if you go through all that, we'll show it again at the end. But I have the world the way it is today, and that this should all be kind of together early on. But
so would Dr. Clary, would that, what we just watched there, would that have been including the continents actually breaking apart at the same time? If it was like in real time, we were, you know, above the earth watching this happen.
Yeah, I just left them all in their position of where they are today. Sure. So in reality, during that first sequence, don't worry about the names like the Sauk and all that. They should have been really close together. And slowly moved apart. You know, early on they didn't move too much, but then they really started moving. When you made the whole new ocean crust, it was really about the point where you really start to flood the land. And so that in this chart, we call a mega sequence. So I look at them as chapters of the flood. And you kind of lump together some of these traditional geologic names. But the evolutionists believe in the chart that's on the left side, where they see there's a big, that little curve in the middle is supposed to show sea level. So when it goes to the left, it's supposed to go higher. So down here, 1 and 2 and 3 is supposed to be really high. And then it goes down in 4. So that kind of curve in the middle. And then it goes back up again in 5 and 6. But what we really see is what I show on the other side. On the right-hand side, you see kind of a flood that just progresses upward, starting in the Sauk, typically, you know, those first 1, 2, and 3. And then goes really high in 4. And then reaches the peak in 5. And then goes down. And so I've tied this into the days of the flood, you know, around the end of the Cretaceous, that peak. That's the day 150 of the flood year.
And wow. So
that's kind of described in the book a little bit better.
So that's where the Bible says that the mountains are covered to a depth of 20 feet.
Right. And you didn't have most of your mountains until after the flood was starting to recede. So most of the mountains of the world all formed in folded up flood rocks, like the Rockies and the Andes and the Himalayas. Almost all those mountain ranges, except for the Urals and the Appalachians, which formed a little bit earlier in the flood year, most mountain ranges all pop up at the end, all at the same time, which again is another mystery. How can 80% of the world's mountains all form at the same time? You know, a lot of it's because of the, you know, the kind of reaching equilibrium again after the flood and all that turmoil going on the earth. Things are just popping up all over. And so you see all this rapid movement, even before humans got off the ark and before the animals got off the ark, all this kind of thousands of feet of uplift of these mountains while they were still on the ark. And then they got out and they were able to get places, and you know, most of the movement was done at that point. But you see the contrast between what they say on the left side and what I see on the right side. Mine follows the data. Theirs is just a theoretical model. But they think there's a big high point of the flood. And I presented this at a geology conference, a secular geology conference. I said, where's the evidence of this high sea level? Supposedly the Cambrian, Ordovician, Silurian, those 1, 2, and 3 numbers. When you look at the rocks, you don't see that. Yeah. So let's move along and I'll show you what I mean. So here's the Sauk. The coverage of the Sauk mega sequence, you can see the dots are my data points. Ignore Australia, it's not done. I just got the data compiled, but it's not in the maps. But areas in blue show where those rocks are today. So there's been erosion, like uplifts and things, mountains, but that's really where the rocks of this earliest sequence are there today. So this would represent the Cambrian explosion and some of the Ordovician rocks, the earliest flood sediments with marine critters.
So this is where the waters covered the earth first.
This is where the water covered these areas first and maybe a little bit more. But you see, just North Africa is covered. You see, most of the United States is covered except for a strip down the middle. But Canada, Brazil, Southern Africa, you know, the central part of Europe and Asia, high and dry. They weren't even being flooded yet because we see that same pattern in the next sequence.
So let me ask you again here, just so to make sure I understand what I'm looking at.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you know that these are the areas that were covered first? What is the where is the evidence that these are the areas that were covered first?
Well, these would be the rocks that contain the same marine fossils only, which were defined as, you know, Cambrian or Ordovician. The lower,
because when you learn about this in like a secular science classroom, they don't make a distinction and they just say, oh yeah, the Cambrian.
Mm-hmm.
The impression is it's all over the world, but you're saying, right. No, these are very specific areas
it's only here. This is it. You can go to India, you won't find it. You can go to Southern Africa, you won't find it. It never flooded those areas, I don't believe. You know, there has been erosion, so it looks a little wormy. There's some holes and stuff in places because the Himalayas came up and eroded a lot away. But you see the same patterns. You notice across Europe and North America and the next one, and I move ahead. So you go to the next one, you see it's almost the same area across Europe. To go back, I can go back one and forward again really quick.
Mm.
Back two. But you see, it's North Africa. It's North Africa, the next sequence on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
North Africa, again, the third sequence after that. Now you start to see a little more flooding up, especially north of Europe. But there really isn't much difference in those first three sequences. That's why they're all marine fossils. You're only flooding shallow seas, I believe, that were covering much of the United States and parts of Europe, you know, parts of North Africa. Those are areas where you have a lot of oil today. But these are areas that were flooding first because they were the lowest elevation. Maybe these huge shallow seas. We don't really know what God created the original world like, but apparently there was this huge shallow sea. So all you find in Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, where I grew up in Michigan, is just marine fossils, because I believe that was, you repetitively kept burying things with these tsunami waves, but you weren't really flooding too high. You're just flooding the shallow seas. So that's why these first three, I'll go through them again. You start here, they're the same areas pretty much, here, here, and here.
Still, so all the water is sinking into the, filling the areas that are of the lower elevation.
Areas that are blue. And the green and the brighter colors are thickest, but that's not as important at this point. But notice Africa is still high and dry. Canada, most of it is still high and dry. Part of easternmost or westernmost Siberia is still high and dry. Norway's, Scandinavia is still high and dry. Greenland, high and dry. And then, again, this is the data. So you move up to the next sequence, and here all of a sudden things start to change.
Mm.
And I guess this is day 40 to 90 because the Bible talks about the ark start to float on day 40. And now you see more coverage all over the world. You see more coming in across Africa to the south. And again, it's wormy because of a lot of erosion since the flood. But you can see that the general pattern is suddenly there's a lot more coverage. It doubles the coverage in terms of surface area. It over doubles or triples the thickness and volume at this point. And this is where we see all over the world the first major coal seams and the first significant numbers of land animals mixed with marine animals all at the same time. There, before this, there's almost no land animals, almost no coal.
And that would that be because most of the animals were able to escape the initial waters coming up?
I think all early on it was just flooding the shallow seas. It wasn't really affecting the drier land. And that's maybe why the Bible talks about 40 days of rain early. Doesn't talk so much about flooding early, but the flood progressed, the flood process progressed, because now you start to really make seafloor, according to John Baumgartner's theory, and you start to make a whole new ocean crust starting at this sequence. The oldest ocean crust goes back to this sequence.
And then this would be because, and correct me if I'm wrong, but because mostly coal seams are because of plants being crushed and buried. Is that correct?
That's correct. So now you're flooding, you're starting to rip away the plants on the land, just like tsunamis do, and you're burying those plants in mass, in this huge mass. And you look at coal seams, they're flat top and bottom. There's no evidence of roots coming through. There's no evidence those are swamps. I'm finding coal beds hundreds of miles offshore in the South China Sea. I'm finding coal beds off shore off around Australia. I'm finding coal beds that oil wells drill into the Arctic Ocean north of Siberia. And there's no evidence that these areas, they're now, some of them are 3,000 feet of water. or 3,000 meters of water. There's no evidence these areas were ever dry land. So it doesn't fit the evolutionary model at all. These things were washed off as though most of that was when the flood was receding.
Yeah.
So it pushed things way, way out there. We're finding dinosaurs 70 miles offshore Norway. We're finding all these animals and plants that shouldn't be in these locations. Even around Iceland, there's plants trapped in between the lava flows. They can see the fossils between some of the lavas that didn't totally destroy them.
And now, so along those same lines, you know, I've heard that they find in I don't know if it's both the North and South Poles, but in the very, very cold parts of the world, they actually do find vegetation and other things that we wouldn't typically think of being there. Is that correct?
Well, in the South Pole, because you have land there, the North Pole is just ocean crust. But
yeah,
but you're correct. In Antarctica, 5 or 6 years ago, they found trees, fossilized trees, that still had original proteins in them. And again, just like dinosaurs are finding original proteins in dinosaur bones, are finding trees that in Antarctica that didn't live there. They moved down there during the flood year. Antarctica shifted to the south. We believe when you put Pangaea back together, Antarctica would have been about maybe where Australia is today, and it would have been a more temperate climate. And so you could grow these trees, but as, during the flood year, of course, Antarctica slid to the south, and then they, during the ice age, they froze over. But underneath, they're still finding evidence that there are plants living in these. Same thing is true in Alaska underneath the, and in Greenland, underneath Greenland. I think that's you're referring to. They find plants that were growing in Greenland before the ice built up right after the flood ended. And so things are very warm after the flood because it made a whole new seafloor. So the ocean is very, very hot compared to what it is today. And that caused a lot of evaporation, caused a lot of snowfall because of the volcanoes that were erupting and peaking at the right time. You know, God's timing is perfect. So he brought on the ice age after the flood. Because of the flood and then making the new seafloor, heated the water. Also, there were no deserts. You know, Egypt began its civilization not in a desert. It was all well watered, just like the book of Job talks about, you know, water and snow more than any other book of the Bible.
Now, that's not something I've heard before, that Egypt was well watered before when the civilization started. So you're talking after the flood waters have receded that the earth would still, the deserts were not.
Right. During the Ice Age, yeah, we have actually put a few articles out that even the evolutionists see the evidence during the Ice Age of the Sahara Desert wasn't there. There was rivers and lots of water flow. Over several thousand years, of course, it all dried out. And areas 30 degrees north and south of the equator became these big deserts. But initially, these were well-watered areas, a little cooler than now as well. But eventually, the earth kind of went through all this, a lot of cycles, and just kind of settled out, and these areas became deserts. And that's when people had to rely more on the river, you know. But early on, why would you start a civilization in a desert?
Yeah.
Think about the conditions of the flood. It's completely different. And even Israel was, you know, land flowing with milk and honey, even the time of Moses, which was, you know, 1,500 years or so after the flood. So it was still better water than it is today. But anyway, go ahead.
I'm sorry. How many days passed? So we go from the fountains of the deep bursting forth all in one day. How many days would it have been until the ice age started?
Well, gee, it's hard to say. It might have taken years for it to really begin what you call an ice age. It might have taken even 100 years after the flood to really start building up significant amounts of ice. And so if you want to call that the ice age, where you started getting, you know, thousands of feet of ice, it might have taken 100 years. Mike Ord and others have estimated that maybe 200 years at the most. And it might have only lasted 500 or 700 years. You know, once the oceans cooled down and stopped evaporating so much, and the volcanoes stopped erupting so much, it was blocking sunlight to cool the earth, then everything would have started warming up, and you lost your ice, except for the Antarctica is still there to remind us, and Greenland's still there to remind us. The rest of the ice melted off. So we've already had, you know, global warming, and sea level has already risen 350 feet. But what was important about the ice age after the flood was you had to lower sea level so you could have the animals walk from the Ark to every continent. And the only one they would have to swim a little bit to was Australia, which you could walk across Siberia right to North America. It's dry land. The water was warm. It's going to be a little microclimate, so you wouldn't have ice right along the oceans. And you see barefoot human footprints on islands offshore Canada during the ice age. It was warm enough they were walking barefoot.
That's one of the big questions people have anytime I get into discussions. Is people say, how did the animals get from the Ark to all the different continents? So it is that the ice basically, because it was so
land bridges,
you had much lower sea levels.
Yeah, so you could walk across, you know, Siberia to Alaska. You could walk across, you know, pretty much anywhere down to South America. There was more land. If you look up, go to Google and look up, you know, the map of the maximum drop in sea level during the Ice Age, you'll see a pretty good map. You could walk from Europe, continental Europe, right across to Ireland.
Wow.
You just could walk right across. And there's civilizations that are buried under the water. They're finding, you know, evidence of stone, you know, footings basically for houses under the ocean today in the North Sea because they were dry land
Yeah.
for 100 years.
I was just reading that they've off the coast of Japan, they found an entire like city underwater, like a Japanese Atlantis.
Yeah, if you drop sea level 350 feet or so, like it did, you know, God had a plan. I mean, the flood was almost like dominoes. Once it got going, he knew what the end result was going to be. And he knew this is going to do this, this is going to do this, this is going to bring in an ice age. And humans were disobeying. They were going to miss those land bridges because they were sticking around in the Middle East. And so God had to kind of get in there and said, let's confound their languages, you know, the Trinity said.
Yeah.
So they finally spread out. And it might have taken several hundred years to get across Asia. You know, people still moving. And then eventually they followed the animals across. But within, you know, maybe 700 years after the flood, sea level came back up, sealed off those areas. So North America, we have to use boats to get over there. But the animals are there because of the flood, the way the flood progressed and ended, caused a really hot ocean crust to heat the water, caused all the evaporation, which came down as snow in the north, you know, the northernmost regions. So it wasn't necessarily, you know, ice covered in the Middle East, of course, but it was rainier and wetter and probably cooler at the time. But here, this is the important point. This Absarica or Absaroka mega sequence, which I think is day 40 to day 90 or so, is because the ark is now floating after day 40, the Bible talks about. And no, you now, you know, you obviously are flooding the land then if the ark's floating. So here we see all those coal seams show up all over the world at the same time. Land animals show up all over the world. And you see a lot more flooding compared to what we saw. If you go back one, see that much flooding in Africa, all of a sudden a lot more. And so this, again, doubles and sometimes triples the surface coverage that's there today, even after all the erosion, during the Ice Age, et cetera, afterwards. And then if you progress along to the high point of the flood, I believe this is the high point, when you reach day 150. And if you look up in Canada, way up there, there's a couple of little blue dots. You scoop in really close. Hopefully you can see that.
Yeah, I see that, yeah.
This is the maximum coverage globally. And so the detractors say, well, it doesn't flood everything. I'm like, well, no, it did, but it was going across so fast, it didn't leave much behind. And the Bible tells us why. It says that, what, 15 cubits over the highest hills.
Yes.
So Southern Africa and Canada and Brazil and Ukraine and Norway was the highest hills. How much sediment can you leave if the water is only 23 to 25 foot high? You can't leave a lot of sediment. And so you kind of leave little remnants here and there. I call it the bathtub ring up in Canada. There's no way to get those little blue dots there unless they came in from the side. And so they had to have flooded more of that. There had to be more flooding to get those little remnants out there that we still see. But the Bible tells us why there's not a lot. It's because it didn't flood really high, but it was zipping across real fast, like tsunami waves do. Even in shallow water, they still maybe might have been going 60 miles an hour.
Wow, this totally changes my perspective. I mean, this is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
It really, the insight you get from the research you're doing is really interesting.
I love following data. I mean, data tells you so much. I'm like, huh. Then you go back to the Bible and realize, okay, that explains it. You know, the God's word is our only truth we have. But the rocks are real. You know, data is real.
The rocks cry out, right?
You know, the rocks do cry out. And it's, I just feel so blessed that, you know, I get to be the one to show this out there. And to me, I don't consider it work at all. I don't work at ICR. I get to play at ICR every day and, you know, progress along. I wish I could have done this quicker, but we have other, you know, we have to write a lot and we speak a lot.
Yeah, well, we're blessed.
Tell people what we found, but, you know,
we're
but
blessed to have people like you that have the experience and the education to be able to look at this data and actually interpret it. You know, it's pretty cool.
And some of it, I'm still trying to soak it in my head. It's just like there's so much information there that some of it we haven't even hardly opened up the, you know, the can and looked into it. So when we get everything done, we're going to go back and put the world back the way we think it progressed along from a very tight fit to as it moved along and really take a look at why we see thick areas and thin areas. And we're even keeping track of some of the sediments before the flood rocks came in that might have been part of the earliest flood, maybe part of the fountains of the deep. There's a lot of pre-Cambrian sediments in Australia but every continent has some. And so that's something I didn't show, but there's some things I need to go back and look at. There's a lot of things to try to glean out of this data that I'm just beginning to
really Yeah, have. I'm sure people are going to have all kinds of incredible insights over time. And just to clarify again for our listeners, for those of you listening, what you're looking at here is the progressive flooding of the earth mm-hmm. based on the amount of sediment laid down over time, that is sediment laid down on top of sediment. And what you're looking at right now is the peak level of the flood. And it looks like, you know, based on this, you know, don't misinterpret this. This is not saying that these parts of the world didn't flood. It's simply saying that because of the rapid flooding, there was no ability to set sediment down in these particular areas.
It wasn't very deep in the highest hills either.
So a question here. So when you're looking at these and on your data points, basically there's a strata layer that's just not there. It doesn't exist. Is that right? What?
Sometimes that happens. You don't always get all the sequences. Like Grand Canyon is missing the second sequence. You've got the first sequence, then you jump to the third sequence, and there's, you know, it just didn't flood. The waves didn't come in and flood the area. There are locations in the world, like in China, there's a spot, and there's one in Syria, there's one in North America, there's one in Australia, a couple that shows all the six sequences. And so there is places where you see pretty much a complete record. People can argue you're missing something here or there, but you've got all these chapters of the flood are all there. Most places, though, you don't. Most places, you're missing one or two. In the highest areas, of course, you may not have anything there because it was eroded away, what little bit was eroded. But what's significant about the Zuni, as we call it, is the maximum surface coverage that's there still today, even after all the erosion, you know, since this happened. And it's also the maximum thickness, the maximum volume. So I'll show you a couple of graphs at the end to show the volume to kind of show the idea of the progressive flood. But here, this will be the high point, I think. And then this is day 150 and beyond. So you see a lot more shifts offshore. Those green areas and yellow areas, that's thick areas. So you look by India, you see the Bay of Bengal is really green and lit up.
So explain this again as far as, because I think I may have missed this, but
okay,
the shading, what is the shading exactly?
The shading is showing, the color at all shows the extent of it, that this particular sequence is there today.
Yeah.
And there's obviously more because you see little dots here and there, just like the last one. But the brighter the color, the green colors, and they usually have a scale in my book that shows the amount of how many kilometers thick it is. Some of these are multiple kilometers or miles thick.
So is the dark blue the thinnest?
Dark blue is the thinnest. And then
it goes to light blue to green and then
greens and the yellows and the oranges, those are the thickest. Like the Gulf of Mexico, there's 20,000-30,000 feet of sediment out there that washed off the continent and just dumped. And that's where we find all the oil in the Gulf for the most part. Same thing off the Amazon. You see it off all around the South China Sea. You see it all around Southeast Asia. You see it off the Niger Delta. You see a big kind of a light green blob coming off there.
And so this is
going. If they drill further out, you'd probably get even more.
Now you nobody else has done this worldwide assessment like this. Nobody's done this.
No, only ICR is allowing me to do this because they're paying me a salary. So this is the only, to my knowledge, the only data like this in the world. And it is, I would say, at least 80% repeatable, because someone else could go out there and do the same thing. And I've gone to conferences and people in oil and gas have said, oh yeah, that's what we see over here. And that's what we see over here. Because I'm using their wells that they brag about. But there are some places where they don't always drill all the way to crust. And so like in Egypt, they'll stop. They hit the pay zone and they don't drill deeper. And so I have to kind of guesstimate, best from working the areas around it as best I can. And so there's a little bit of interpretation, but for the most part, I would say it's 80% rock solid, pardon the pun. That's the response to here.
So the other question I have, Dr. Clary, is are there, for secular geologists or just people out mm-hmm. in the public realm or whatever it might be, in business or in oil or whatever, mm-hmm. is this information useful to people outside of exploring the evidence for the flood? Is this stuff that people are going to be like, wow, I want some of this information?
Well, I think the oil and gas companies like it. When I go to the conferences, the first conference or two we went to, the oil and gas companies, but they cost a lot of money to go to the conference because normally their companies pay for it, like when I used to work for Chevron. So they cost a lot more money. So I started going to more academic conferences in geology, the secular conferences, but we'd show one continent at a time. And usually you get quite a bit of interest. I mean, people, because you don't get to look at the big picture. People want to see what the big picture is. And as I mentioned earlier, they don't let you do that. The oil and gas company says, here's your little basin, you work it, find some prospects for oil. You know, work this little area offshore, this area onshore, wherever. You don't get to look at the big picture. And as a geologist, you like to kind of like get back and look and say, okay, what am I seeing across this continent? To look for trends. It's always looking at patterns and trends. And so there's value in, again, a lot of this I'm still trying to digest myself. It's probably the rest of my career I'll be trying to sort through. Once I get the data gathered and the maps made, there's always going to be more insights that God will hopefully give me enough wisdom to sort it out. I was in my book, I talk about the last chapter. I tell people to read chapter 20 in my book first, because it's called It All Makes Sense. You know, when I was running before I got arthritis in my knee, I was out running here in Dallas, and I was like, it just kind of hit me all of a sudden, like, this all makes sense. Seafloor went up, this did this, all these things, all kind of like the whole domino thing that God started with the fountains of the deep bursting, miraculously bursting the fountains of the deep, caused the plates to start to move, and it caused the plate, you know, the whole rapid plate movement to slowly began and continued and progressed, and then flooding the whole earth in 150 days. And then, you know, they stayed on the ark for over until day 371. But the earth was dry, it says in Genesis 8:13 and 8:14, even before they got off. So the water had drained off because you had to have time for the vegetation to grow. Because why get off the ark if there's no food? And so the animals, God had them all stay on the ark until there was just enough grass for the animals to get off and eat, or whatever vegetation was. So it was about 60 or so days of they kind of just had to wait and stay put because all the food was on the ark. And there was just dirt, day 314 until day 371, the guy finally said, you can open the doors and let them out.
But I mean, that's phenomenal.
The timing that I see that God has is just amazing. I mean, I'm getting this much of God's insight, you know, this much wisdom.
Yeah.
It's almost mind blowing sometimes to see how it all works and how it all kind of makes sense. And
it is, it's amazing. And and you're getting down to nitty gritty stuff. I mean, you're quoting, 371 days. That's incredible that we're able to, put this puzzle piece back, all the puzzle pieces back together. And then, like you said, see the whole picture like this.
I was just gonna move along while you're talking.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, you keep talking. I just moved it along.
What I was gonna say was, there are a lot of weird formations. I have students that sometimes will be traveling cross country, or they'll be in another part of the world. And they're alumni that have graduated from school they'll take photos of really strange geologic features and they'll send it to me and they'll say, hey, Mr. Conover, worldwide flood, and I'll be like, whoa, that is wild. So does the research you're doing help to explain some of the unusual geologic features we see around the world?
I think it does. I mean, because you can put them in context. I can go back and look at the columns near that area and kind of see where those rocks fall. And then it makes a little more sense. But you do see a lot of weird things, like there's a lot of evidence of sediment that was still soft that was being deposited and buried so quickly that the sediment almost squirted up and made these really cool folds. We just saw some over by Rock Springs, Wyoming this last summer when ICR was out and a little sample collecting for some research we're doing. And we looked at these what's called soft sediment deformation, really wild folds in between the layers. The layers are flat, and then all of a sudden you get these really wild folds in this one layer. And so some of that is definitely had to be folded while it was still soft. And we see that even these big folds in the mountains, all these really tight folds in these rocks, they had to fold it while they were still soft. And it's, this was fresh after the flood was over. It's when the mountains rose and they still were packed down. So some of them fractured and broke, but overall they're able to fold really tightly because they were still soft. Today you try to fold rocks, they just shatter.
Yeah.
You can't fold rocks, but you can fold packed down wet sediment.
And that's even more evidence that it all had to happen pretty rapidly because, like you said before, there's no erosion in those folds between a flat layer, a bottom layer, and yet you've got these clear folds where if there was erosion, they would be eroded. They you wouldn't have such a clear, nice...
Yeah, there's even folds in Grand Canyon that my friend and colleague, Andrew Snellings, got a chance to sample, and he showed the thin sections and rocks that there's no evidence of these rocks breaking at all. They were still wet, as if they just... You get the exact same thing if you took wet sand and kind of folded it, which gives you exactly what we see. But this is kind of a summary. This is for people that love bar graphs. This is the six sequences as you go along by continent. And you can see the first one over there in green on the left side is the sock sequence, which is chapter one, working along. And I believe the yellow is the receding phase. The brown is the peak. And it's because Africa really shows that Europe flooded a little bit earlier, flooding the purple, which is the Apsarica, because I think a lot of Europe wasn't really high ground. It was sort of the mid-range. It was like a swampy lowland area. Whereas most of the continents, you had upland areas like Canada, Brazil, and even India in southern Africa. So when you add it all up, you see that kind of volume at the end. I believe it's Asia. I think this is the final one after five continents right here. So you can see at the bottom, hopefully, the different sequences. You see that actually the first three are almost all the same. Around 5% of the volume of these six sequences is contained in those first three sequences. Very, very little flooding. And those are all marine fossils. And the progression of those, when you look on the maps, they could do the surface area as well, but I didn't want to belabor the point. You see that's the minimum coverage. So all three of those show minimum flooding, same areas over and over, because you're flooding the same shallow seas, just a little bit higher each time. And then you get to the Apsarica, the purple one there in the middle. That's when you see what I think is day 40 and beyond, because now you're flooding, and you see the land animals show up in great numbers. You see coal seams show up in great numbers. And that continues throughout the rest of the flood. But before that, there's almost no land animals and almost no coal. And so to me, you're hitting that. The waves are now going high enough to flood the dry land, the pre-flood dry land, all over the world at the same time. Now, that's the thing. It's the same pattern, the same essential pattern of the rocks on every continent. You know, even though Europe flooded a little bit earlier because I don't think it has much high ground, didn't have the highest hills in Europe in the pre-flood, as you saw in other continents. But nonetheless, when you add them all up, this is the combined total of five continents. And I'm seeing the very similar pattern in Australia as well. But I'm kind of anxious to get that in there.
And that pattern that you're seeing, that is that the strongest evidence that this mm-hmm. is worldwide and not just localized floods? Because that's the secularist mm-hmm. view. Millions right. of years, localized floods all over the world.
If you go back and you look at, you know, these maps, you see the same pattern on every continent. You know, you see the progression of the flood starting out here with minimal flooding or in the earliest, you know, the Cambrian Ordovician layers, you see the same areas being flooded again. And I'll show that little diagram at the end where he stacks them all on top of the little cartoon. But it's accurate. And so here you see the same areas for the first three, and all of a sudden, boom, there's a lot more. This is that purple area where you start to see coal seams. And then you say, boom, there's the maximum. And then you see that the maximum isn't much different than the receding phase going down. But here you suddenly see everything shifting offshore. In the Gulf of Mexico, at the bottom of this sequence, there's this huge sand that's 200 miles offshore that's over 1,000 foot thick that they have no explanation for because it's so far offshore. My chief geologist at Chevron said, well, you know, we wouldn't let you look that far out there because we didn't think there's any sand. He goes, but we were wrong. But he never would have said that when he was my boss. You know, they know everything. But
yeah,
they wouldn't even let us look out there because there's, to this day, that's been discovered 20 years ago now, there's no explanation for why you get this, what's called the Whopper sand. You know, go to icr.org and look up Whopper sand, and you'll see a couple articles I wrote about it. How there's no explanation for how you get over 1,000 foot, almost 2,000 foot thick sand in the middle of the deepest part of the Gulf of Mexico. Right at the wow. base of this receding phase, where I think the water shifted direction from advancing to going off, and see a real high energy water rushing off the continents and dumping the sand deep in the Gulf of Mexico, as deep as you can go. And after that, it's all clay. And they're expecting to find a few feet of sand and mostly clay, but they found a whopper sand. They just, to this day, they can't believe it. But you know, they don't really care because they found 15 billion barrels of oil in it.
Yeah.
You find 15 billion barrels of oil in it, you don't care how it got there. But they don't even consider a flood.
And
that's not.
And that is terrible. And that is crushed. Those are crushed animals. The oil is from crushed animals. Is that right?
It's mostly from marine algae and plankton from the marine realm. And I have a whole talk on that as well. But you know, they try to tell me the oil is millions of years old in Wyoming. I'm like, it can't be old. It's original organic tissue. It's just like the dinosaur soft tissue. Oil can't be millions of years old. It's all
oil
young.
Grades.
Oil. When you're pumping gas, even though you complain about the price. That's a creation moment because you're putting in gasoline refined from, you know, dead marine plankton that God provided for you into these shales all over the world. And they got buried deep enough that the oil cooked out of those shales, collected in these traps that we can drill into and find. Just like the coal seams, he provided the coal for our resources, knowing that we would need that today in
yeah.
the last 100 and so years, knowing that we need oil and gas today, it's providential that God planned all these things. Of course, we need to burn it clean. You know, you can't just burn coal like we did in the 19th century. Everything becomes covered in soot. And the Chinese are still doing that. So even though we're on Zoom, I'm not afraid to say it. Chinese are still burning coal rampantly. And, you know, they're polluting their country and the world. You know, if these people are really interested in global warming and climate change really, really cared, they'd be saying, you got to stop too. But, you know, they just ship everything over to China and say, here, you burn it. You know, we're going to keep our area clean. But it's the world. You know, so it's, you know, it's a little bit of politics mixed in there. I apologize for that.
That's okay. I mean, it's the reality is the word of God speaks to all issues, right? We're called to be stewards of the world. So
but we're supposed to be good stewards.
You know? Yeah.
I'm an environmentalist. You know, I really do not like pollution. I think we polluted way too much. I worked in groundwater cleanup when I was going to school, studied all that in graduate school. And there's so much pollution out there that, you know, we need to try to clean up. But at least we stopped polluting so much, but other places still are. To me, that's more of a problem than CO2 will ever be.
Absolutely.
But to me, you really do see the progression of this flood. I mean, it goes right along, and you add them up again. Here's what you see. This is the world total. And the same thing is true of the surface area that's covered. I could have shown the same graph. It's almost identical to how much surface area is covered early versus later. And you see it all peaks in that brown one, the Zuni. You know, they're almost the same.
Yeah, it's really undeniable. I mean, the worldwide flood, based on the data that you're sharing, is pretty much undeniable. There's no other explanation.
Mm-hmm. And that's why I show that graph sideways. I turn it sideways. You see the progressive flood just kind of each sequence kind of comes in, a series of tsunami waves, hundreds and hundreds of them. But it keeps building over 150 days and peaks in that Zuni right about the end of the Cretaceous. Now, some of my colleagues out there in the creation world, they'll say the flood was over at that point. But I don't believe it was. I think the data really showed that this was just the high point of the flood. And no offense to my friends and colleagues, there are some disagreements in the creation science community on some ways. And it's okay. You know, it's kind of healthy for science to keep you having to figure out, okay, why do I say this? Why do I believe this? But I think the data really supports that there was a year-long progressive flood. That's what the rocks show. That's what the seafloor was created, according to John Baumgartner. You know, as you made more seafloor, you pushed more of the ocean crust up. And so early on, you weren't making a lot of seafloor. Fountains burst open, they're shooting out water, they're shooting out lava. You know, there's the miracles there. And it didn't go back. If you go back one more step, Earth is the only planet in our solar system that has tectonic plates. Mm. So I think it's because God broke them all open. You know, the fountains of the deep, the first day of the flood, he miraculously burst all these cracks all over the Earth. And then that caused some of these plates to actually be able to sink because they're higher density at the surface. And coal, so they sank into the Earth. And once you used up all that ocean crust, that conveyor belt, and everything kind of stopped, and that by then the flood was at its end. And so the continents moved apart. They're stopped today almost, you know, they're only moving this much per year. Because it wasn't that long ago. You know, these big 60-mile thick plates, they're 60 miles thick. They're moving around at a pretty good pace, and then just to stop them, it totally is difficult to do because everything's kind of sliding around like a Rubik's Cube, you know, kind of thing. And you just kind of turn one, it all kind of affects the rest of it. But
that's amazing. Well, we're running out of time here, but
let me run through this one more time. Here's the pattern again. We see there's the first and the second on top of it, and the third one on top of that, and then all of a sudden, boom! It really floods, and then you see the maximum flooding, and you see it going down. And so, to me, it's a nice little summary to show that at the end again. But,
that is phenomenal.
Good. So, to me, you know, once you put these continents back together and move them during the flood year, we have a globe at our Discovery Center here in Dallas, or we have a museum called the Discovery Center. You can see this in 2 minutes, and you can see it's moving under the water. You know, you just see what's above the water moving along, and it's pretty dramatic. And in my book, I show the patterns of each sequence where the continents were together as they moved apart, the next one, the next one, the next one. And so
that is cool. That is amazing. Wow. Well, that is, for those of you who just hopped in here, Dr. Tim Clary has done tremendous work on this, and Carved in Stone is his most recent book. He's got a lot of books that you can look into. ICR.org. Yeah, there it is.
Carved in Stone. Plug. It's about 4.5 pounds.
Hey, that is worth
plugging. It's got lots of maps and diagrams and pictures.
Buy that for your geology professor. If you're a student of geology, buy that book, give it to your geology professor. Let them try to figure it out. That'll put a rock in their shoe to to force them to go, wait, I got to figure this out.
Well, yeah, you know, the data is real. And so
Yeah.
if nothing else, the middle chapters in there, it shows each, you know, each of the six sequences, and it shows the data. In this case, only three continents, but the pattern is identifiable with three continents, just like I'm seeing on the other three that I'm still finishing up. But it's amazing. I mean, it's just the insights that you can get from collecting data and looking at the following data, and God giving me this little bit of wisdom by praying for wisdom gives me just enough insight to like, oh yeah, but there's a whole lot more still. There's a lot more work to do.
Well, you said before we end here, you said that you've got Australia left to do.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was the last one you were saying.
Yeah, I've just finished up compiling the data for Australia. I've got over 400 and some columns in Australia. I've got over 3,000, I think, worldwide now. It might not seem like a lot, but you look on the map, it covers every major.
That is a
thing.
Lot. That's
but I've got
incredible.
To do a little bit. I've got to shift a little bit further offshore to New Zealand, and then I've got to do what I can around Antarctica. There's data around the edges of Antarctica, but that one's going to be a little tough because I don't know what's going on in the middle.
So what kind of research, you know, if you had your way, what kind of research would you do after you finish this project?
Well, I want to look at the pre-SOC or the pre-flood sediments. I've been compiling that in my database as well, which is, I think I mentioned earlier, some of these what's called pre-Cambrian sediments. Every continent has significant amounts of sediments that we need to sort out. Is this from the earliest part of the flood, from the fountains of the deep? Or is this part of the pre-flood world where you're just seeing like these rivers are draining off, leaving these massive deltas, because the Bible does talk about rivers. So we got to piece the world back together again and see why does Australia have so much of that? But yet it's not just there, it's on other continents as well. But it is smaller compared to, I've compiled all that too, and it's about a little bit above those first three sequences. You see a lot of pre-Cambrian sediments.
That's below the Cambrian.
So below the Cambrian. And so they're pretty much devoid of fossils, except for there's some algae and things that are found in them. And so it's
so
not,
it would make sense.
Traditionally
it would
not
make...
thought of to be the, it was traditionally not the, what I don't think is the true flood progressing onto the land. It's just a material that might've been near the fountains of the deep and they're bursting open. There's a lot of volcanic activity, like, and there's also a lot of sediments, but it's all locally. These are more localized. But in some cases, they're very significant and thick, thousands, tens of thousands of feet thick.
So you think that it's possible that that's actually land that was there prior to the flood?
Mm-hmm. Wow. Some of it might have been, and some of it might have been part of the earliest flood as well. So I've got to sort out, you know, how much of this was those 1600 years that might have built up some sediments, particularly offshore on the kind of margins and areas where deltas might have been draining the oceans. Again, it's hard to tell what the pre-flood world was like. I could get some general ideas. I get shallow seas. I get a lowland area, and I get an upland area. That's about all I can really glean out of the data. You can kind of see what floods first, and then what's the fossils that contains, and then you can see the fossils in the next part, and that's how you can kind of see, you know, you went from the swampy areas to upland areas. That's where flowering plants appear later in the rock record, just like most of the mammals appear later in the rock record, because I think they were living at higher elevation. Probably with humans. So humans and dinosaurs probably lived in separate areas because dinosaurs are tied to their plant sources that God made for them in lowland areas. And maybe a few thousand feet higher is where most of the mammals, horses and camels, and, you know, lions, tigers and bears and all those things that we don't find with dinosaurs. We find birds with dinosaurs. We find little mammals with dinosaurs that lived in swamps, but we don't find the traditional pigs and horses and humans really with dinosaurs.
Yeah.
At least none has been reported.
Sure, know. Sure. Yeah.
There probably is some mixing during the flood because animals are being tossed around, but they kind of were buried near, to some extent, where they were living. And except for one over the top, then it kind of went every direction. So you see a lemurs up in islands up the northern part of Greenland in Canada, in just some of the islands like Baffin Island, and you see the same lemurs in Wyoming. And between you had, you know, it's Canada, but they were shed in both directions. So
yeah,
some interesting things that you find just by, you know, keeping tabs of things. But to me, this has been the greatest labor of love. I don't even consider it work. And it ultimately, it shows people that it really was a flood. There was a global flood, just as the Bible describes. And if that's true, then, you know, the love story of the Bible shows you how God was, through his own shed blood, God himself was able to come to earth and died for us. You know, it's done. We can't do any work to earn our way to heaven. It's all through Jesus, the shed blood. He did it all. We just have to believe in it. And
praise God.
Why did that? You know, he shows the judgments. He shows what happened. Failures of everybody throughout history. You know, failures of David, failures of everybody. Everybody sinned except Jesus himself. And but he's also offered, you know, redemption through his blood. So we don't have to worry about it. You know, we just ask him for forgiveness. And so ultimately, Amen. That's what the book is to show, is if Genesis is true, then you can believe the whole Bible. You can believe anything in the Bible. If you can believe there's a flood, it's been knocked down and kicked down. And, you know, people say there's, I'm not a scientist because I joined ICR, blah, blah, blah. But I'm doing the best science of my life. I've never done science on this extent, this much data, you know, having this much of an impact to show people there really is evidence of a global flood. So if you're a Christian out there and you've been doubting, you know, if you're just blindly believing, you don't have to blindly believe. You know, there's enough evidence to show that there really was this global flood that the Bible talks about.
Absolutely. This has been really fantastic. I feel really grateful for your time and
I feel grateful you guys called me up and set this up. And, you know, if you want to talk dinosaurs, we can do dinosaurs sometime too.
I'm excited to have you back on again, man. I feel like we could talk for quite a while. So I want to keep picking your brain. So
we could, yeah.
Yeah, thank you, Tim. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate and, you guys.
Yeah,
what
and I'm looking forward to having. What's that?
I said we want to show people salvation is right there.
Amen. Yeah,
it's free. Right. It's a free gift. It's Christmas time. The ultimate free gift was Jesus Himself laying down His life for all of us.
Amen. You know, God Himself. That's wonderful.
Laying down His life for all of us, not just His birth, but He came to die and to forgive us.
Amen. Amen. Thank you so much. Such a big blessing. For those of you listening, if you want to look more into Dr. Clary's work, icr.org. Mm-hmm. And like I said, he's got a lot of resources, great articles to read too. Share them with your friends, share them with your family, and they'll be blessed. They'll be, you know, astonished by the evidence, and maybe it'll crack the door of their heart, and they'll mm-hmm. give God's word another look. So keep praying for your family. Don't give up on them. Even when sometimes it seems like they're hard-hearted or hard-headed, don't give up. Christ doesn't give up on us. So thanks again, Dr. Clary, and I look forward to having you on again.